Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today you're in for part six of our heartbreaking group of snackering geniuses. This is George Saunders, who's published two books of short stories, Civil War Land in Bad Decline, Stories and a Novella, is available in paperback from Riverhead. Pastoralia is his new book, also a book of short stories, from Riverhead. And of the group that we've got here, I would say that he's the maddest and the wildest and the one who takes the gloves off most. The fiction, unlike a lot of the books like, well, Infinite Jest, which clearly are books that have at their center someone who went mad at the university. This is a writer who went mad in mining school in Colorado, and then where? Java?
A slaughterhouse. Yeah, Sumatra.
Uh-huh. And so I wondered, what got you started writing stories?
Well, I was from Chicago, from the South Side, and I think early exposure to Hemingway and somehow the idea that a writer was cooler than a lot of other people. But then being from where I was from, I didn't start till late. And I don't know what really got me started. I think Dybeck at some point, Stuart Dybeck, was a big influence later. But I tended to think more in terms of TV, I think, or Monty Python, or the sort of sketch comedy. That was a real early thing. And the stories, I wrote one, I went to engineering school and wrote one there, a comic story as an assignment, and that was kind of the start of it.
I know that when Dave Eggers started talking about you, he said that when he read Sea Oak, his breath was taken away, and at first he thought, what is this guy doing? Is it classist? Is it racist? Is it sexist? And then realized that it was none of those things, but a writer coming from, sympathetic with, compassionate toward, a background that doesn't really make its appearance in a lot of experimental fiction anymore.
Yeah. Well, I read that piece last night in San Francisco, and I felt the same way. I couldn't figure out where it came from, but I do remember as I was writing it feeling deeply sympathetic with the people and with their real life predecessors, and the main thing, the main feeling is not wanting to sneer, wanting to somehow talk about the things in my life that have been like this in a way that doesn't clean them up, doesn't hygienize them, doesn't short sell it. And I have very little intention when I start. I try to have none. And then as I'm going, I'm always just responding to the previous sentence, and in the faith that if I do that, in the end, something intimate with me will come out. So I don't know. I mean, I compassion is important to me in everything. And although I never would have thought that Sea Oak would be the particular manifestation of compassion, it's not what I would expect,
Sea Oak is the middle story, more or less, in Pastoralia. Saunders's characters tend to be those people who really have been dealt out of the deck. The 40-year-old virgins, the people too ugly to have gotten much love, the people who get fired from all their jobs, mentally dislocated, undereducated. And in this story, a relative comes back to the family to say, hey, no need to be a martyr anymore. There's nothing on the other side of life that makes suffering worthwhile here. Hustle, prostitute, sweat, cheat, do whatever you can, but get in the swing of things, because there's nothing going to rescue you God word on the other side. I thought we'd listen to the beginning of the story, the first couple of pages of Sea Oak, which, when it appeared in the New Yorker, took my breath away.
At 6, Mr. Frent comes on the PA and shouts, "Welcome to Joysticks." Then he announces, "Shirts off." We take off our flight jackets and fold them up. We take off our shirts and fold them up. Our scarves we leave on. Thomas Kircher's our beautiful boy. He's got long muscles and bright blue eyes. The minute his shirt comes off, two fat ladies hustle up the aisle and stick some money in his pants and ask, will he be their pilot? He says, sure. He brings their salads. He brings their soups. My phone rings, and the caller tells me to come see her in the Spitfire mock-up. Does she want me to be her pilot? I'm hoping. Inside the Spitfire is Margie, who says she's been diagnosed with chronic shyness syndrome, then hands me an Instamatic and offers me $10 for a close-up of Thomas's tush. Do I do it? Yes, I do. It could be worse. It is worse for Lloyd Betts. Lately, he's put on weight and his hair's gone thin. He doesn't get a call all shift and waits zero tables and winds up sitting on the P-51 wing, playing solitaire in a hunched-over position that gives him big gut rolls. I pilot 6 tables and make $40 in tips plus 5 an hour in salary. After closing, we sit on the floor for debriefing. There are times, Mr. Frent says, when one must move gracefully to the next station in life, like, for example, certain women in Africa or Brazil, I forget which, who either color their faces or don some kind of distinctive headdress upon achieving menopause. Are you with me? One of our ranks must now leave us. No one is an island in terms of being thought cute forever, and so today we must say goodbye to our friend Lloyd. Lloyd, stand up so we can say goodbye to you. I'm sorry. We are all so very sorry. Oh, God, said Lloyd, let this not be true. But it's true. Lloyd's finished. We give him a round of applause, and Frent gives him a farewell pen and the contents of his locker in a trash bag, and out he goes. Poor Lloyd. He's got a wife and 2 kids and a sad little duplex on Self-Storage Parkway. It's been a pleasure, he shouts desperately from the doorway, trying not to burn any bridges. What a stressful workplace. The minute your cute rating drops, you're a goner. Guests rank us as knockout, honey pie, adequate, or stinker. Not that I'm complaining. At least I'm working. At least I'm not a stinker like Lloyd. I'm a solid honey pie adequate, heading home with $40 cash. At Sea Oak, there's no sea and no oak, just 100 subsidized apartments and a rear view of FedEx. Min and Jade are feeding their babies while watching How My Child Died Violently. Min's my sister. Jade's our cousin. How My Child Died Violently is hosted by Matt Merton, a 6'5" blonde who's always giving the parents shoulder rubs and telling them they've been sainted by pain. Today's show features a 10-year-old who killed a 5-year-old for refusing to join his gang. The 10-year-old strangled the 5-year-old with a jump rope, filled his mouth with baseball cards, then locked himself in the bathroom and wouldn't come out until his parents agreed to take him to Funtime Zone, where he confessed, then screaming into a mesh cage full of plastic balls. The audience is shrieking threats at the parents of the killer, while the parents of the victim urge restraint and forgiveness to such an extent that finally the audience starts shrieking threats at them, too. Then it's a commercial. Min and Jade put down the babies and light cigarettes and pace the room while studying aloud for their GEDs. It doesn't look good. Jade says regicide is a virus. Min locates Biafra, one planet from Saturn. I offer to help, and they start yelling at me for condescending. You're lucky, man, my sister says. You did high school. You got your friggin' diploma. We don't. That's why we have to do this GED shit. If we had our diplomas, we could just watch TV and not be all distracted. Really, says Jade. Now shut it, chick. We gotta study. Show's almost on. They debate how many sides a triangle has. They agree that Churchill was an opera. Matt Merton comes back and explains that last week's show on suicide, in which the parents watched the reenactment of their son's suicide, was a healing process for the parents, then shows a video of the parents admitting it was a healing process. My sister's baby is Troy. Jade's baby is Mac. They crawl off into the kitchen, and Troy gets his finger caught in the heat vent. Min rushes over and starts pulling. Jesus freaking Christ, screams Jade. Watch it. Stop yanking on him and get the freaking Vaseline. You're going to give him a really long arm, man. Troy starts crying. Mac starts crying. I go over and free Troy, no problem. Meanwhile, Jade and Min get in a slap fight and nearly knock over the TV. Yo, chick, Min shouts at the top of her lungs. I'm sure you're slapping me, and then you knock over the freaking TV. Don't you care? I care, Jade shouts back. You're the slut who nearly pulled off her own kid's finger for no freaking reason, man. Just then Aunt Bernie comes in from Drugtown in her Drugtown cap and hobbles over and picks up Troy, and everything calms way down. "No need to fuss, little man," she says. "Everything's fine. Everything's just hunky-dory." "Hunky-dory," says Min, and gives Jade one last pinch. Aunt Bernie's a peacemaker. She doesn't like trouble. Once this guy backed over her foot at Food King, and she walked home with 10 broken bones. She never got married because Grandpa needed her to keep house after Grandma died. Then he died and left all his money to a woman none of us had ever heard of, and Aunt Bernie started in at Drugtown. But she's not bitter. Sometimes she's so non-bitter it gets on my nerves. When I say Sea Oak's a pit, she says she's just glad to have a roof over her head. When I say I'm tired of being broke, she says Grandpa once gave her pencils for Christmas, and she was so thrilled she sat around sketching horses all day on the backs of used envelopes. Once I asked was she sorry she never had kids, and she said, "No, not at all, and besides, weren't we her kids?" And I said, "Yes, we were, but of course we're not." For dinner, it's Beanie Weenies. For dessert, it's ice cream with freezer burn. "What a nice day we've had," Aunt Bernie says once we've got the babies in bed. "Man, what an optometrist," says Jade.
George Saunders, reading from the opening sections of Sea Oak from his new collection, Pastoralia. This was once the stock of working class fiction, but something's happened that's made it, that's tossed it onto another level, a higher frequency, a stranger vibe. And I wonder, what is that something? What takes you out of the realm of realism?
I think it's a deep desire not to slum. And I know in my past, when I've tried to write out of my experience in a way that might be more in keeping with, you know, some perceived tradition, it always, I don't know, maybe this is a defect in me, but somehow I end up getting on the other side of the table from the people I'm describing and condescending. And that's not acceptable. So somehow, to fully credit the emotion that I feel about these people, I have to depart from reality in some way. And again, I'm not exactly sure why it is, but I know that, for example, in that story, before the critical incident that we're sort of talking around, so I don't ruin the surprise, which is supernatural and odd and strange, I had tried literally 300 pages of alternate endings that were every single one of them more conventional and more realist. And the energy level just dropped at that point. And so when I'm writing, it's all about energy, and I will do anything in the world to not be dull and to not do something that's been done before. So in a funny way, searching around for that place where the energy surges up is what I do. And only after the fact I can sort of say, well, philosophically, it's because of this and this. But at the time, it's like a guy skipping across a stream on the stones. You're just trying to get from stone to stone. And technically, that has to do with everything, plot structure, all the language, everything. But at the time, I just don't want to be found out. When I was a kid, I lived in Chicago. And there was a family on the corner who was very poor. And because they were poor, they were also very cheap and frugal. And the house was underfurnished and always smelled like kielbasa. And they were not giving people. Well, one day the kid of that family came over and said, "I've got Chicago Bear tickets," which were a real big deal and a lot of money. And I was stunned. And so we went into the city with his father, stopping at 7 or 8 different Polish relatives on the way in. And, you know. So, but it was unbelievable that we were going to go see a Bear game with this guy. So we get to and his uncle came with us, we get to the gate of Wrigley Field, and the father pulls us aside and he says, "Now, boys, there's something I got to tell you. We don't exactly got 4 tickets. We got 2. And so he said, "But don't worry, we got a plan." And the plan was the adults would take the boys on their shoulders, and then our feet would have to go down their overcoats. And the mythology was that the Andy Frayne ushers would never look up. They would just take the tickets with their heads down. And so we were just going to sneak through this way. And I was appalled. I was a good little Catholic boy, you know, never cheated, never lied. And I said, "Well, what if they do look up?" And he says, "It's not a problem. All you got to do is act retarded." And then he said, "Show me how you're going to do it." And so he made us make the face, make the, you know, the face that we were going to use. And then, you know, there we went through the gate. So for me, fiction, it's funny. It always brings me back to that moment just before we went through the gate. I just don't want to get caught. You know, I don't want to have somebody say, yeah, it's kind of boring, you know, or yeah, I've seen that before. It's really important to try to stir it up. We did get through, by the way.
Something seems to get stirred up, in fact, between you and the page. I mean, there's more anger running in the current of this writing than anyone else's I know writing right now. You know, a kind of frenzy gets cooked up. Yeah. Can you describe that? What's the...
It's not really anger, I don't think. I'm very happy. I'm a relatively happy person, have a really, good life, but... for me, the experience is all stylistic. It's about, you've got four sentences lined up and in a conventional progression. And if you cut the middle two, suddenly something is there that wasn't before. And over many years of writing, it's become visceral. I look at a sentence and automatically I rearrange it and try to cut. And then the resulting sentence is denser. And now... how that relates to anger, I'm not sure, but I think the compression always amounts to more emotion or whatever stripe. So for me, the purpose of writing has always been to be the kid at the party who says, "Look at Uncle Jake, he's lying out the side of his mouth." You know, the one who sort of pokes at the structure. But I hope with love. I mean, there's no fun in demolishing everything. You know, life is wonderful.
Well, let's define that, though, because, you know, the love that's going to appear in these stories as it leaks out is unconventional, first of all. Second of all, it's not what most people would define as loving. In fact, the stories make fun of self-help, of imaging, of ways that people have of jump-starting self-esteem. What is love in these stories? It seems as if love is accuracy, or love is not lying about the essential awfulness of things.
I think it's I think first of all that what love there is I think is in the voice. In other words, the position of the author towards the material is loving. If you have a story where no one was wearing pants, that ends up being a praise of pants in a sense, you know. So I think if you know, there's an American tendency to mistake the happy ending for the love, but in this case, I think that the love I feel has to do with my attitude toward the people. You know, I try not to condescend, but I hate lying. I think that there's a lot of positive thinking lies that are in the air, and the effect of those things is to tell people who are in pain that they're not, you know, or that if they are in pain, they caused it. They're at the heart of it, and I very much like realism. You know, the truth, the frank looking at what's going on.
I'm speaking to George Saunders, whose new book Pastoralia has appeared from Riverhead Books. You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. Now, we've been talking about compassion, but these stories and novellas are in their way better known for misanthropy and mayhem.
Yes.
And I think for many readers, that is their energy. They're not going to go to these stories to look for compassion. Compassion is a byproduct of the stories. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the... these are some of the less kind stories one's likely to read.
Yeah, it's troubling in a way, because when I work on them, it doesn't feel that way. And when I step back from them, I can see it. I mean, my whole thing, I've come to grudgingly accept this, but at the beginning of the story, there's me and there's my little pathetic dog called Talent. And I say, okay, boy, go get me a pheasant. You know, be like Tom McGuane, be like Hemingway, be like Chekhov. And the dog runs off with great certainty and verve, and I'm very happy. And he comes back a half an hour later with, the lower half of a Barbie doll. It's not what I wanted, but every time it brings it back. So I guess I'm just sort of thinking, well, if it works that way every time, and if you're in a state of mind of compassion and, you know, whatever, and technical, concentration when you're doing it, it must be okay. It's not for me to say, you know, I'm going to put some nice nuns in or something. I have to you know. It's like if you have a painter had a certain brush stroke and it was always the same way. Well, you have to work with it at some point.
Now you've read David Foster Wallace and Dave Eggers, and well, do you feel that there is a new voice gathering?
I think there is, but I also, somehow my mind tends to connect dots backwards. So rather than say, I mean, I think the clear sort of change has been maybe from the sort of dominant new realism then to this new mode. But to me, what's more interesting is to look back and say, okay, we can connect this group, certainly with Bartholomew. We can connect them. And in a funny way, I can connect them with even with Twain, and I can certainly connect them with Gogol. And I find more sort of in common, it helps me more to look that way than to say, well, what's the next wave? Because at any given time, all the waves coexist. And I think Wallace and Eggers, they're both funny, hilariously funny. And I sense the same kind of compassion and the same kind of, no matter what's going on technically, one eye is on what I'll call morality, or I don't know if that's the right word, but spirituality, or some kind of sense that what we do here matters and that literature is one of the most important things that helps us mediate. And whether it's ironic or it's like, you know, that I don't really care that much about, but the writers I love are the ones who know that we're in 40 years, we're going to be dust, and our actions, they matter. And that stories and literature, those are the things that help us act better. Now, I would hate to get, I'm not saying, you know, that stories should have a moral, but I do think that that's, it's like this. You're at the beach. You have a shirt on. If you take the shirt off, whatever the weather is, you feel it more acutely. For me, literature, good writing, makes you take the shirt off. And if it's 20 below, you feel it. If it's red hot, you feel it. But I go around much of my life with 5 shirts on. And when I read, you know, when I read Wallace or Eggers or Bartholomew or Carver or anybody, the shirts come off, and at least for a little bit, you are out there. And depending on who the writer is, you might say, oh, it's 80, it's sunny, I'm glad to be alive. Or you might say, Jesus, my nipples are hard. You know, but either way, you're more in the world.
You're overexposed,
yeah, which we need to be. I think to act properly, you have to be overexposed.
Now, among your influences, you mentioned Gogol, who's one of my favorites, too, and a specialist in limbs that leave the body and take life in other forms. In the nose, of course, the nose leaves the narrator of the story and begins parading through the streets and, in fact, refuses to recognize its owner. I wanted to talk to you about the use of mutilation, or the usefulness of mutilation in fiction.
Well, I think it has something to do with, okay, there's a working-class performance tendency that immediately translates to me into crudity of some kind, fart jokes, scatological humor. Now, as I'm thinking about it, when I do it, there's probably some level of insecurity. I'm not sure I can do subtle. You know, I'm not sure that I can come up with an example that's nuanced enough to communicate what I need to communicate. So what I do is I sort of throw something approximate at it. In other words, if I say, isn't the barber's unhappiness, he has no toes. Now, clearly, a better, more nuanced writer would have another way of communicating this guy's imperfection. That's the whole point of it, is he's going to have a gross physical imperfection and then at the same time nitpick the woman for hers, you know. But for me, it's just, okay, no toes. And I'm not sure, but I know I feel that tendency at the time as a broad indicator of something psychologically subtle, but then I don't come back and tune the indicator. You know, it just stays there.
Well, what happens, it seems to me, is the delicacy of these stories, weirdly, is the juggling act with which one crudeness after another is put up into the air, and eventually there's a kind of weird ballet of ugliness, crudeness, various kinds of intensities, sadism, hilarity, and like a Philip Guston painting, or like a Bruegel, or like Lenny Bruce, there's a certain point where you've gone beyond the possible, beyond the tasteful, beyond the available, and a kind of anti-gravity poetry. Yeah.
Well,
starts
you know,
to
that's, and one of the things that occurs to me is that the higher pleasures of art have to do with arrangement of elements, not with the content of the elements themselves. So, if, as you say, it's four different degrees of decadence in the air, somehow our pleasure seekers go after our internal pleasure seekers go after the arrangement of the four decadent elements, and that in some way is and for me this dealing with a sort of base inarticulateness has become the stylistic driver for me. You know, I know I'm not that well educated and certainly not that well read, so for me there's a great deal of experience in passion without verbal skill to communicate it, both in childhood and, you know, and people who were incredibly passionate and intelligent and underfoot who couldn't say it. And that to me is very beautiful. And that's what, so some of the language things I do in the stories are related to that. But I think also this idea of juggling the crudenesses, I can't do more than that, but putting them up in the air is very pleasurable, you know.
Now, this is the final question, and I just figured it out.
Oh.
The culture is frequently being criticized for becoming cruder and cruder and cruder and cruder, as if there is no level of debasement that American culture is not going to be willing to show us. Mm-hmm. To what extent do these stories participate in that crudeness, and to what extent do they place it on display, on exhibit?
That's a great question. I think, maybe I'll turn it a bit and say, I think our problem is not crudity, it's stupidity, and it's inattention. So if you go to, if you make the list of the 20 crude things, you'll, to my ear, they're not of the same flavor. They're stupid. They're, you know,
feelinglessness is crude.
Yes, and lack of context and lack of attention to the task at hand. So Sally Jesse Raphael is crude. A news reporter talking earnestly about the Monica Lewinsky thing as if it's important is crude and stupid. But those of us who write fiction that's whatever you want to call it, I think if you've inhabited it and you treat it with love and you do your job by taking, you know, 7 months to write a story, then you're not crude. And I understand the concern, and I'm, you know, and it's not
concern on my part.
No, I know, but I mean, but I've had it myself, and I have friends who've, you know, I know that when I'm writing them, it's a holy place, and I'm not trying to pulling over on anybody. I'm there, and it's the I have an active spiritual life, and that's one of the most important components of it. So somehow I trust that we as a nation are bright enough to not mistake, you know, the crudity for
the moral core.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to George Saunders, the author most recently of Pastoralia from Riverhead Books. The previous book, also available in paperback from Riverhead, is Civil War Land in Bad Decline. Thank you very much for joining
Thank
me.
Thank you for having me.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in bucks.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse Club Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.